Greetings, folks, and welcome back to the podcast. I am your host, Bamba. I am also the Ufahamu Africa podcast non-resident fellow, and I have the pleasure to come back for another installment for the fellowship. And this time, we will be talking about the protest movement in Senegal. And my guest today is none other than Bour Sotal, freelance journalist in Senegal, Chevening scholar, and she will be discussing with us the recent uprising in Senegal. Bour Sotal, it is a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Bamba, and hello, everyone. Always a pleasure to have you talk with me about what's happening in Senegal. And yes.
Awesome. So my first question is, how are you? It's been a hectic few days.
Yes,
for everybody living in Senegal right now, you and I included. How are you?
Mm-hmm. I am doing as great as I can. I have a naturally positive mindset about a lot of things in life. Trying to stay positive. It's mm-hmm. not positive out there, but I'm trying to stay personally positive in order to step a little bit outside of the box and kind of watch what's going on, mm-hmm. analyze and talk to people. You know, I'm just coming back from a round trip again, a shorter one this time. Mm-hmm. It was just a 3-4 day trip inland, and got back last night a bit tired, but ready to go. And I spend the day, half of the day outside to see what's happening. There was a march scheduled for today, and it was unauthorized, so no one was out. And mm-hmm. I just wanted to see it with my own eyes, what the mood was outside, you know, how are people going by the day. Mm-hmm. So looking forward to the march tomorrow.
It seems like, and we will come back to, you know, give you a the trajectory of what happened mm-hmm. last week and this week, mm-hmm. right? But it seems like there is a kind of a normalcy in Dakar. Like, people are out there, you know, running errands. Most businesses are open, except maybe mm-hmm. few banks. Right. But other than that, the chaos we noticed last week, it's no longer there, right?
Well, you know, Tabaski is coming up very fast. It's on the way. I think it's end of this month. Mm-hmm. So people are still focused on that, even if political matters are on top of every talk right now, as it's been the case for the past, I don't know, I cannot even say a few weeks anymore. It's been always like, you cannot go in a group and talk and end the talk without mentioning anything political. There's no mm-hmm. way that can happen in every conversation, at every corner of the city, of the country. You know, it's always before or even at the end of the conversation, no matter what the topic was, Sonko, Macky Sall, you know, will always come back up.
Yeah.
But Tabaski is coming up now, and I think people are kind of thinking about that as well. You have to buy the sheep, you have to, you know, prepare clothing for the family, you have to organize the house.
Mm-hmm.
Families are still mourning, not even have. Yesterday and the day before, we saw families bury their children mm-hmm. dead from the riots. And so families are mourning. But outside of the very dark, you know, mood of this political season, mm-hmm. I think people are still just going on by their business, because there is Tabaski coming up, but there's everyday life as well.
Yeah.
People live and they have to live. So
yeah,
it's just the day to day. Yeah. But the talk is still political.
Yeah. And I know I talked with you on my podcast, The Africanist, a few days ago, and I was on the other side of the Atlantic, and you mentioned mm-hmm. when I asked you, what is the sentiment like? What is the mood mm-hmm. in Senegal like? And you said to me, psychosis was the most shared mm-hmm. sentiment. And me mm-hmm. now being here, I can see it, I can feel it, right? And mm-hmm. it's real. Mm-hmm. People are yeah. traumatized. Or have been for the last 2 years. And what happened last week was unfortunately kind of expected. Now,
yes.
What I want us to do is we will talk about some of the events that led up to last week's uprising. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So for the listeners who are not aware of it, last week, Senegal saw another popular uprising, similar to the one of 2021. And it was a result of the trial that opposed political opposition leader Ousmane Sonko to Haji Sarr Massouz, who accused Ousmane Sonko of rape and death threats. Now, the case was tried last week, and Ousmane Sonko was found guilty of corrupting the youth. We will talk more about that. But the rape charges and death threat charges were dropped. Consequently, he was handed a 2-year prison sentence, but also another person was also tried and sentenced. And that person is Ndaye Ndiaye, who is or was the owner of the massage parlor where Haji Sarr, the accuser, used to work at. And she was handed a 2-year prison sentence, and she just appealed, actually, the sentencing, right? Now,
yes.
Prior to all of that, there were some interesting elements that led up to the sentencing and then subsequently the uprising. We will talk about some of those elements. So the pre-trial events, what happened inside the courtroom, the outcome of the trial, including the deadly uprising. But I also will talk a little bit about the reaction of the people, especially feminist movements in Senegal, who seem divided, actually, right, about this issue. Now, what I want to ask you is, what happened weeks or days prior to the trial? We knew that Ousmane Sonko retreated to Ziguinchor, a city southwest of Senegal, where he is the mayor, and some interesting events happened there before Sonko was brought back to Dakar. Could you tell us more about what happened in Ziguinchor?
Maybe we can just take it back from, remember I was in the Pays Basari when we were last talking. And after that, I went to Ziguinchor because Sonko had been there days before to retreat while waiting for the trial to happen or to, you know, and so he was there, protected by the people, and a lot of noise around him staying in Ziguinchor. Why was he there? Why would he not stay in Dakar? Why is he running away from Dakar? Is he running away from the trial? You know, a lot of rumors about the trial making him afraid and wanting him, making him retreat to Ziguinchor because that's where he feels more like home, et cetera, et cetera. But what people forget, actually, is that he's the mayor of the city, you know, and that's where he gets all his strength from, basically, you know, that's the stronghold. And he is the mayor of Ziguinchor. So how abnormal can we think of him going to Ziguinchor if this is his retreat zone? As the mayor of the city, it's very normal for him to be there. Just basically very normal. He has his home there. He was in his house, and he was protected by the people in the neighborhoods, and even people coming from other regions of Senegal.
His supporters,
there,
right?
His supporters, yes. When I was in Ziguinchor, I went to his house. I could not enter, as no one could. at the time, and just beating people outside. People were coming from Kaulak. People were coming from Djourbel, from any other. I've seen people just come from various regions of Senegal, all in support. But at the very beginning, it was just the people of his neighborhood, Ziziguinchor, and then the neighboring villages. Women came from Bignona to pray for him. You know, others came to cook for him and cook for the people around, and just supporters around the house, protecting the house so that the police forces would not have access to him. Yeah, and then supporters just shielded his house, like you say, and for like 2 weeks, they just stayed around until I think May 24th when he decided to, I think it's May 24th, when he decided to organize a caravan to say hello to people and even cross the country because the trial was coming up, but also he was coming back to Dakar.
Yes.
So that's how things started, I think. To just sort of disturb the whole agenda that was scheduled and for him and about him in the rest of the country. Because he was crossing Ziguinchor all the way to Dakar by car. And that, of course, he called it Caravan of Freedom.
Yes.
And that meant a calling for people to join him on the way. And obviously, as we have seen already, thousands of people are after him, you know, surround him whenever he is out. So whenever he is out with the public, he is the man of the public. He belongs to the public, who is just of all ages, young people, older people, you know, just everybody. So we've seen the same scenes everywhere he crossed until he, I think it lasted 2 days.
2 days, yes.
Of the caravan. Yes, and then he was arrested and brought back to Dakar by force. Because
I mean, he was given a ride to his home, right? Not sent to prison.
Yes, he was given a forced ride. No. He wasn't taken to prison.
Yes.
When he began the caravan, the authorities took out a note and said that that caravan was undeclared, meaning that it was unauthorized because he did not ask for permission to do so. But then knowing Sonko and knowing the whole meaning of civil disobedience and the whole purpose of it in this context, and understanding also why he would call it Caravan of Freedom, meaning that he doesn't feel free at all in this country, nor are his supporters. Mind you, in the past days or weeks before the end of this trial, people were still arrested, you know, and some people were in jail for previous gatherings and money and strikes and so on. So he called it Caravan of Freedom for a purpose. And so 2 days after he began that caravan, he was arrested and taken directly to his house and not to jail. The Caravan of Freedom was stopped by the authorities because it was not authorized.
The other important element is that also while his supporters was shielding his house for 2 weeks, they clashed with the police and the gendarmerie for 2 weeks.
Oh, yes,
the
they did.
The police tried to enter Sonko's house and arrest him. There was a warrant for his arrest. And
but you know,
they clashed with the supporters and they were not able to do so. So they sent contingents of police and gendarmerie to Ziguinchor to arrest him. And they did not succeed.
I was on site when this was happening. The police could not even get close to his neighborhood. That is important to say. That means how shielded the entire neighborhood was. It was just not Sonko's house. I had to pass many roadblocks, and roadblocks made by not the police forces, but by, or the military, but by the people themselves, just to be able to get to his house. So the whole neighborhood was just blocked. They cut down trees in order to, you know, just to have that roadblock. And it was all protected.
So they put, you mentioned they cut down trees and lay them across the streets, but also sandbags, right? Bricks, any obstacle they could find to
anything
prevent the
find.
Police cars or the dragons,
anything
as
they
we call
find.
Them,
and
from
they
entering.
Would, and they would also, exactly, and also to in order to have gas to light their fires, you know, areas where they lit fires, or where they would burn tires, etc. They were stopping the motorcycles and sort of ordered them to give their gas. Like they would empty the gas tanks of motorcycles just so that they could get the gas and go use it. So there was a moment gas, motorcycles were not passing by either.
Mm-hmm. So
you
they,
see what
they,
I mean? If
they
you pass
use...
by and you have no purpose, you have no reason for being there, they will not only chase you out, but they will also use your gas in order to, you know, to have enough to burn tires. Or if cars were passing by and they were, they had no reason for being there, or they were not authorized by the people to go around there, they would just burn. So there were cars, you know, completely burned down.
Yes.
New cars. I went there in the evening, and the young people were just all in hiding their faces. They were all explaining to me, you know, why this car was here, how it got caught, and how, but no human being was hurt. So they don't hurt the people unless you resist. They don't hurt you. They just ask you to leave and then they will burn.
Yeah. And I spoke with some protesters who were in Ziguinchor, and they told me that many of the young people who drove what we call the Jakarta, which are, you know, motorcycle that people drive as that they taxi, they use as taxis. They told me that the young people who were not at Sonko's house or outside of Sonko's house, waiting and protecting him from the police, those who were driving their motorcycle were stopped and asked why they were not by, you know, their side protecting the leader. Did you see anything like that happen?
The people that I interviewed gave me the reason why. They were actually very mad at the people who were still driving their motorcycles. Now, when you get outside of Dakar, the main transportation mode in the regions and towards the villages and remote areas is the motorcycle. So that people listening to us will understand why the big presence of motorcycles in these parts of the country. So in Ziguinchor, the main transportation mode is the motorcycle. So people use it at any time of the day to go from one place to another. Now, the young people I met, when I say young, I mean people, most of them are young, between the ages of probably 17 to 23, 24 and up, you know. But the ones at the first part of the roadblocks that I met, they told me, actually, as I was speaking to one of them, one was coming back with a bottle of gas, of petrol, from a motorcycle he had just stopped. And the reason being is that they're angry at the people who are still working while they are sacrificing their lives to stay and protect Sonko. You see what I mean? So they're mad. They're like, how can you decide to go and keep working while we're here? So at the same time, it's important to highlight that the very people who were protecting Sonko also had their day jobs.
Yes.
So they were taking turns. Somebody who told me that they came from, you know, afternoon and they are going to spend the night. Others would come from night to the morning, and others would come from the morning to the afternoon.
Or so they had, if I understand correctly, they had shifts, like three shifts.
Yes,
night
had,
shift,
just
afternoon,
like a restaurant.
And evening, and evening shift.
They will just, exactly, they will have shifts. But the interesting part of those shifts is that their jobs do not know their whereabouts after they leave the job. So no one knows. Somebody will go and work from one period to another and then come back at Sonko's house and protect, you know, fight if necessary. And the next day go back to work and nothing happens. So no one knows who was on site. Between themselves, they know each other. But outside of that, they don't. And when I was talking to them to also protect their identity, I had to ask them to hide their faces so that I would not, like, the I'm sure you've seen on social media the videos I shared, talking to some of them, the little bits that I shared because of space. I was showing feet, you know, an angle that I was filming while talking to them. I even had coffee, Cafe Touba, with them, and we shared it, and they talked. I witnessed one group who had not eaten yet being served, and they ate, and they talked to me, and they shared their experiences, where they were coming from, how they felt about the whole situation, and how much it will take them, or how much worth it is to them to stay there and protect their leader. And why they're doing it.
Yeah.
You know?
And you know, you mentioned something interesting. The fact that many of these protesters now cover their faces, which is, to me, something quite interesting, because I'm not saying it didn't happen in the past, but at the rate that we see people hiding their identity today, it's unprecedented, basically. And
well,
to
because
me,
they know
that
they're going to be,
yes, that indicates how terrified and how also autocratic our governments has become, that they can go and round up people who post on social media, people who show their faces on social media criticizing the government. And the only way, or one of the only ways, these people can avoid prison or jail is to cover their faces.
And in that case, I think it's strategic on their end, because they know that if they're caught, then they will not pursue their mission.
Mm-hmm.
So might as well play on the side where they will protect as much as possible by all means necessary, including hiding their faces. But the way they talked is so strong and so confirmed in them that they're willing to die for this man and for the project. So I don't think they are afraid of showing their faces. I think they just want to stay alive and stay active on the ground as long as possible. Because the moment that they are caught, the moment that they're identified, that's the moment they will be caught. And as a matter of fact, very recently, we saw one video that was taken, one interview that was made by an international
That was Al Jazeera.
Yes, Al Jazeera. And they interviewed a man. And right when he was answering the questions and expressing himself, they caught him right there and there.
Yep. He didn't do nothing. He didn't do anything.
No, he did not do anything. He was just exercising his right to speak.
And he was talking to the Al Jazeera correspondent in Dakar.
Exactly. And Nick Hack, who was the correspondent, was just standing there, unable to do anything, simply because there's nothing to do. They are the police forces. They pulled his arm and they arrested him.
And he spent days in prison.
Yeah, and SoCo supporters understand that. So they know that they have to work on their best ways to stay alive and on the ground as long as possible, including hiding their faces.
Yeah.
But when they speak to you, you clearly understand that their motivation has reached the highest level ever seen in Senegal, at least with my own understanding of it.
Now, there was also a strong presence of women in Ziguinchor Shore. You saw the women of the Bois Sacré showed up. They were singing songs, also protecting their leader, but also bringing food to the people who were taking shifts to protect Sonko's house. What do you think of that women presence in the, given that this whole thing, because, you know, rape is a serious allegation, and we've seen feminist movements in Senegal saying that this case is negatively affecting women's rights. What do you see, or how do you analyze that strong women presence in Ziguinchor and even outside of Ziguinchor, and this narrative of a segment of Senegalese feminist organizations?
Okay. You know, before national or even international law, before women's rights and everything, there's tradition. And Ziguinchor, which is in Casamance, is a very traditionally based environment. And in that tradition, women have a very powerful stand. For instance, since the 1980s, when the war broke civil war, not civil war, but when the war
the
broke
rebellion,
from
yeah.
The rebellion with the MFDC broke between the state and the MFDC at the time, to this day, but more so in the 1980s, it was women are known to have the last word. So when something happens, when there is an outbreak of any sort, when women come out, you hear population say, oh, les femmes sont sorties. Les femmes du bois sacré sont sorties. Les femmes de Casamance are out, you know. Women of Casamance are out. And which means that when they do, it's almost the end of some process leading to some solution. So women have a very powerful stand. They're very powerful. They don't speak much, but they pray more. And that's what I saw when I was in Ziguinchor, at Sonko's area. So already in the on the kitchen side, women were there just cooking for everyone. So as I was standing there, you would just see sandwiches, hundreds of sandwiches just going, you know, in bags of empty rice, empty bags of rice, just bags of bread, sandwiches going out, and all cooked by women, all served by women. And men would just take it and carry it to the other people on the you know, surrounding streets. Also, something very interesting I saw there, very, very fascinating to me. And this is after having met the king of Usui, which is one of the most traditional villages and kingdoms in the region. I think Usui, the king of Usui, reigns over 17 villages, 15 in Senegal in the Usui area, okay, surrounding Usui, and two others in Guinea-Bissau. So this is a very strong kingdom in Casamance. And I spent the day there before going to Sonko's house. I did not speak politics with the king. I just went to visit him to pay respect to his, you know, authority, and also just see the kingdom itself, what it looks like. You know, the real bois sacré, it did not reach, of course, there as a woman or as any other individual would go there, but just had the chance to sit with the king and ask certain questions and get his advice about life in general. And after that, that's when I went to Sonko's neighborhood. And as I was entering the kitchen, I saw a tree where I saw just other pieces of wood buried in the soil. So, you know, just like the khambu, you know what khambu is in Wolof, right?
Yes.
It's usually seen in the Lebu.
Yes.
They're paying respect to their ancestors. That's the thing. They pay respect to their ancestors. So they had the presence of the ancestors in Sonko's neighborhood. They were chanting and dancing from inside.
Interesting.
It was fascinating to see how, in the process of protecting their leader, women particularly felt the need to pray and call on their ancestors for strength and for protection. So when I asked one of the ladies I met there, I was like, oh, is this from the Bois Sacré? And they said, yes, this is the women who came from the Bois Sacré, from Bignona, you know. And it was so they just carried their tradition to the neighborhood. So for 3 weeks, you have to understand that this neighborhood only belonged to Sonko and his people, basically. And I asked about the neighbors, and I said, so what happens to the neighbors? And they're like, well, the neighbors can come and go, but it has to be cleared. And that same evening I was there, some people were passing around, but they still needed to be checked.
So they needed, they were checking to make sure that there was no...
They were checking to make sure, because of course,
plain cloth, police, yes.
Yes, because police could come as, you know, as civilians.
Civilians, yes.
At some point, those police forces even tried to enter the neighborhood through an ambulance.
Yes, using an ambulance to camouflage themselves.
Do you remember that story, that news that was out? Yeah.
Yes.
So it was through an ambulance. They tried to camouflage, but they were quickly caught. And again, they were all left. So during the time that Sonko was in his house, in Ziguinchor, no police forces were allowed. And the press was very limited as well, which is very unfortunate for journalists, because local journals came to cover the events taking place, but some of them were just taken away by the police themselves, stating that they did not need to be around there at that moment, you know. So I went there as I used a lot of my social work background in order to talk to people. Yes, I paid mind to what they were saying, and I explained to them that they could trust and talk, and that I was making sure that whatever they said to me, I would just use what the people needed to hear, rather than with the intention of jeopardizing their security, you know, and that was important for them to understand so that they could talk to me.
So you were one of the rare journalists who had access to the area and the protesters in Ziguinchor.
Exactly. But and again, I was there as a journo, but mostly I used my social work listening skills and just whole attitude in order to get access to them.
Excellent. Now, let us move on.
And that was important. That was important because people were very tense.
Yes.
Because they just did not, any stranger meant danger to them. Oh, no, they did not trust anyone. You had to show patte blanche, you know, like a clear face in order to have access.
Interesting. So after 2 weeks of trying to arrest Sonko in Ziguinchor and failed, which was to me like a defeat for the government, you know, Sonko decided that he was going to take the fight to Dakar, because this is where everything happens. Dakar is where the diplomatic representations are, the big businesses. So anything that hits Dakar, the whole world will know about it. So I guess it was strategic on his behalf to say that we are going to organize this freedom caravan or freedom ride from Ziguinchor all the way to Dakar. And like you explained a while back, on the second day of the freedom ride, Sonko was arrested, not sent to prison, but he was given a ride to his house and basically placed under house arrest. So it's been, I think, 12 or 13 days since then, and he still cannot leave his house. Nobody can go in or outside of the house, it seems like. And there has been calls for the government to lift the barriers around Sonko's neighborhood. So his whole neighborhood of Sitikar Gurgi is barricaded, basically. And it's very difficult to access there. His lawyers cannot go in or out. They can't see him. And also in the process, when he was arrested, they seized his cell phones, I think 4 cell phones and 2 laptops. They seized that. And Sonko came out and made a statement and said that they seized his electronics and that he doesn't know what the government is going to do with those things. Basically, they could frame him. Sonko was saying that, right? In the, his public address, that they could frame
him. Well, you know, from the very beginning, any chances of being framed was out there for him. That's why he refused to give his DNA or to offer, you know, his DNA for any testing in the allegations of rape, you know. So he saw any step of the government towards him as a threat, and he just did not trust at all. So basically what's happening, or what's been happening since he was forced back to Dakar and, you know, being securely put in his house and unable to come out of it since then, is that it's just basic human rights for him and his family and the whole neighborhood, you know, basically, because it's on his part already. He cannot come and go. He cannot see his lawyers. His relatives cannot see him either. And there's no official document that proves that he is under house arrest. So at the very base of it, that's what's happening for the past few days. You know, Sonko is arrested. He is given a 2-year sentence for a youth corruption and not rape. and he's in his house, waiting for his house arrest, for waiting to be given a warrant, and even arrested. But that's not happening, and he cannot come. He cannot go. He cannot welcome anyone, including his lawyers or even his communications team. No one can have access to him. I think only one person or two, they've said in the news, in local news I've read, that was able to go out to buy groceries and bring it back to the family. That's it. Outside of that, no one is able to go out, even the cleaning people who are in his house. So even the family's cleaning service who stays with them cannot go and come. So this is clearly, and that's what's supported by the lawyers, his lawyers, and any other expert that we get to hear from, just basic human rights violations for him, his family, and the neighborhood, because they cannot either come and go, or they have to be checked very vigorously before coming inside the neighborhood or going out.
Now, many human rights organizations locally and internationally have been denouncing that quasi, house arrest. The other thing is his sentence, and he should be spending 2 years in prison, but they're waiting. Everybody's wondering when he will be effectively arrested and sent to prison. Uh-huh. And this situation reminds me of a Wolof proverb that says, "Sakindandu yomunawai finkai tege mo jafe." Basically, stealing a drum is easy, but where to beat the drum will be the problem. Because, when you beat it, I guess the owner will hear it and recognize the sound and will come back and claim his or her drum. And just to say that applied to Sonko, it's easy to sentence Sonko, it seems like, but when, how, and where to arrest him and send him to prison is going to be a big problem, because anything like that is likely to fuel another uprising. Although the Minister of Justice, Ismail Amaji Ofal, said in a statement that since Sonko is now sentenced to a 2-year prison term, he can be arrested anytime. But so far, that has not materialized yet. Now, let us move on to the trial and what happened inside the court, okay? Sonko did not show up in court because he asked for guarantees from the government to protect his physical integrity. And why? Because in previous court hearings about the case, Sonko was brutalized by the police. He was even pepper sprayed at close range, and that caused him a lot of health issues. And he said that he doesn't want to go to court in under those same conditions when he is being told where to go or where not to go and clash with the police. He didn't want that. So he asked for guarantees from the government. The government said, no, we're not providing any accommodation. So he was tried in absentia.
Yes. So he was tried in absentia. Mm-hmm. He was tried in absentia, and it happened in last May 23rd. So remember, 24th is when he was still in Ziguinchor when the trial was taking place. It was going on in Dakar. So 23rd, the trial was done in Dakar in absentia. He wasn't there, but his lawyers were. But because he was not around, the lawyers could not speak much.
Yes.
Remember.
They cannot speak. It's good to make this precision because, if you are tried in absentia, according to the penal code in Senegal, Article 308 of the penal code says that if you don't show up because, you run away or you decide not to in a criminal matter, your lawyers will not be given the floor. So basically, like you said, he was tried and his lawyers were not even there to defend him.
So 23rd is when the trial took place. Sonko
Yes.
was not present. He was still in Ziguinchor. And by the end of the day, they postponed the results to June 1st, so like a week later. It's after that postponing, the 24th, that he decided that he was going to go and start the Caravan of Freedom. You understand?
Yes.
And that's when it began. And he was arrested 2 days later and forced back to Dakar. So that's how the path, that's how it happened, from the trial to the arrest and back to Dakar trip for Sonko.
Yes. Now, the trial took 18 hours. 18 hours. So Sonko wasn't there. The lawyers were not there, his lawyers. But Ndaye Khadi Ndiaye, who was there. But she also was not defended by her lawyers. So she ended up defending herself for 18 hours, right? While being on an advanced stage of pregnancy. An
That
interesting thing
was
happened.
very, yes, that was a very profound statement you just made, because here is a pregnant woman for 18 hours sitting down, standing up, no matter what happened, she was there defending herself the most. And I think out of every memory, Senegal will remember that moment.
Yes.
And
And
go
And
ahead.
it's very interesting, like Ndaye Khadi Ndiaye, because sometimes she is the one who's forgotten about in this Sonko Ajisar equation. And she plays a huge role in the whole, saga.
Yeah, she
But
does.
most of the time she doesn't come into the purview of analysts and things like that. But another important thing that happened is that while the trial was happening, because cameras are not allowed in there was a supporter of Ousmane Sonko named Fala Fleur. So that's her. She's very famous on social media and one of the most, I guess, recognized faces when it comes to defending Ousmane Sonko. So she's a young activist and supporter of Sonko, who was tweeting and posting like minute by minute what was happening inside that courtroom. So most of the things we know about the trial came from Fala Fleur. Now, unfortunately, she was arrested last week and sentenced to prison this week. So as we speak, she is in prison,
Now,
which is quite unfortunate. And I hope that feminist organizations and other human rights organizations will, defend her, because I think she played a very important role in this trial. While, she was doing that, we've gotten mixed messages from some of these media that was supposed to give us this kind of information, but they failed in their
Well,
mission.
Fala Fleur, before I see the woman tweeting live second by second, we should even exaggerate, because she gave herself out there trying to show, to share what was happening. Fala Fleur before, and her name, Fala Fleur, Fleur is flower in English. She's a flower, she's a plant mixer. She mixes plants and makes beautiful bouquets and sells them. I remember her personally because she sold me before she even became so connected politically. She used to sell me plants. Fala Fleur used to sell me beautiful bouquets, right? I have memories of her just the day before. No, last week I was on travel. Last week, I saw, while just cleaning up my storage room, I saw some of one of her decorations, and I just smiled, and then quickly just had a thought for her being in detention now for simply exercising her right to just come and go, her right to get into court, her right to report, because if the authorities were to refuse complete access to the court, they could have said no to cell phones. But
mm-hmm.
seemingly, if she had her cell phone, that meant that she could, you know, tweet about what was going on. And she wasn't alone. We
no.
had other journalists who was also in court tweeting about this. So
mm-hmm.
these were people who were just there. And Falah Fleur just happened to be one of the very famous ones.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, she was exercising her right to get into court as a civilian, sit down, report, because she still had her phone with her, about what was going on. She was very vocal. She's been very vocal since the very beginning. She is one of those who truly believe that there was no rape case, no serious rape case regarding Sonko. And today the judges gave right to that and, you know, sentenced Sonko for youth corruption instead of rape. So all that put together, I just remember Falah Fleur as a plant seller and a strong woman who has a business, trying to run her business and just being famous for that. She has a very strong social media presence. And most of what we see outside of her stand, political stand, which she also has the right to have, she sells plants. That's how I see Falah. And unfortunately, she is in detention now for being, for having a stand. Most likely in detention because she's against the government stand. Let's say it. Let's just say it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whoever is not for Sonko, whoever is for Sonko has a higher chances of being
arrested. Mm-hmm.
And even arrested and just disturbed, you know, whether you are going to face direct charges or you're just going to be arrested and then released, like it was the case yesterday, the day before yesterday, and yesterday for
Ndeyndak
Touré, okay,
mm-hmm.
The model. She just showed a video where she expressed her feelings about what was going on, and then she was arrested.
She was arrested.
So those are the things that we have
mm-hmm.
Going on in the country. If you are pro Sonko, and you happen to show it, then you're going to be in trouble, most likely. And that's what happened to Falah Fleur. And this is not her first time. In 2021 as well, she was facing difficulties for having the stand in favor of Sonko.
She almost lost an eye in the
yes,
like
she,
a couple
yes,
years ago
yes,
due
yes,
to
yes exactly she has she had
and...
we still have images of
mm-hmm.
her blue eye and those are the memories we have. But at the end of the day, Falah is a
mm-hmm.
strong businesswoman, and today again we find out that she is in detention for having a stand that's
yeah.
against the regime.
Yeah, and there are other women also who, just like Falah Fleur, who suffered the same predicament. I can think of Bintou Sambou,
yeah,
who had a, you know,
and
a toddler.
Yes, exactly. And
mm-hmm.
a lot of a campaign was done in her favor
mm-hmm.
Because of her child.
Yes.
And that did not move the authorities one bit, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
here we have a justice system that seemingly is not aware of the difficulties people they have in detention go through. Their families, you know, themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like you say that Binta Sambou has a toddler. There was this other journalist who is said to be pregnant as well. I think she's pregnant. Choro Mandela.
Serigne Saliou Gueye, who is also
yes.
Still in prison.
Yes, very recently.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Bintou
but out
Sambou?
Of all the press houses, yes, Bintou Sambou.
She's
no,
freed.
Bintou Sambou was not a journalist.
No, she's not. She was.
Yeah,
she's a teacher.
No,
but
Bintou Sambou was not. Yes, yeah, she's a teacher.
Yeah,
but
I know her
Mandela.
Personally. She,
journalist.
We went
oh,
to IGB
okay.
together, so I know her.
Oh,
even Falah Fleur was at IGB
yes,
around the
exactly.
same time I was there,
she's
but I didn't know her.
I think
her.
She studied law. Uh-huh.
Yes.
She studied law.
Mm-hmm.
She says it on her social media
yes.
Handles. So what I'm trying to say is that Pap Ndiaye is a journalist still in jail. He's been the longest right now after Pap Aly Nyaw, who's also freed under condition. But my point, the point I would like to make is that most of the journalists currently or who have already been in jail come from Wolf TV. wealth hajri. And that is important because wealth is known to be that press house completely and always against the government.
The rebellious press house, the rebellious media. Yes.
We can call it that way. First, it was with Sidi Lamine Niasse, who passed away in 2018. And now his son is the he's the director. And the same spirit is there. Wolf is the first to be on site when something happens. He's the one who shares the absolute details of things that happen. And who is always oppressed as well when it doesn't go along the way as that is expected by the government. Yes. And now what we're seeing is that for several times, Wolf TV has been disconnected by CNRA, who is the agency in charge of monitoring audiovisual, the whole
the media.
TV, radio, the media altogether. And so CNRA blocked or cut off their signal. They cut off their signal a couple of times. And the recent one was very recent. I think it's still cut off.
Yes, it is still cut off
right now. Wolf is cut off again. It was out. No, it was on for a few days, and then bam, it just cut off. And so, and right now they're calling for support to Wolf. And interestingly enough, whenever Wolf is cut off, their online presence is like increased tremendously. You know, they have thousands of people following them in just one day. Whenever the news come out that their signal is off. So basically, cutting off their signal is just giving them more power online. And everything goes on social media right now. Everything is happening there. I mean, we have to highlight in this talk the absolute regard or the absolute power that should be given to social media in this whole process since March, especially the Twitter line. It's amazing how so Senegalese people and the diaspora on Twitter shared every bit. You just mentioned Falafleur, you know, who shared on Twitter minute by minute everything that was going on in court. Other people will share by the second everything that comes out. And mostly and recently, and that's what shows the world what's happening, is that whenever there is a an official communique about some event, give them a minute, the social media will come out, people on social media will come out and give the opposite and with proof.
They will fact check everything.
Yes, fact checking is not done by journalists alone anymore.
No.
This is so fascinating to watch. It's just like amazing to see how people will just, of course, next to it, there is a huge, land for misinformation, fake news, etc. But you just, as a journalist, now that's where our role comes in, to check, double check, and make sure that we're not sharing the wrong information.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, and Ami Tomoklo. Our non-resident podcast fellows are Bamba Njaye, Maseke Rioba, Takono Priscilla Sempere, and Kamohelo Tanigo Toledi. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.